Welcome to the Customer First Thinking Podcast, episode 37. My name is Stephen Shaw, the host of this podcast. In this episode, we interview Alan Adamson, the CEO and co-founder of the brand consultancy Metaphors. At this year's Cannes Lions Festival of Creativity, NYU's marketing superstar and provocateur Scott Galloway asked the audience at his packed session to take a red pill. "I think the era brand is over," he bluntly declared, knowing it would rattle everyone in the crowd whose livelihoods depend on brand messaging. This is the same guy who once said, "A brand is the face of a business strategy." Has he suddenly become an apostate? Not exactly. He was simply acknowledging what everyone in the room is reluctant to say out loud, especially if they work for an ad agency or media company. Traditional brand building through advertising is dead. "People aren't watching ads anymore," he emphatically said, adding that many ads are attacks on the people who are unable to avoid them. Marketers have always had a tough time distinguishing between ads that generate sales and branding, or they choose to do one at the expense of the other. They take it as an article of blind faith that consistent brand advertising will eventually lead to revenue growth, because they've been repeatedly told that mind share is crucial to converting shoppers into buyers. The problem facing most marketers, of course, is that saying your brand is better or best does not make it so, no matter how large a share of voice you may have. And getting an ad noticed, never mind remembered, has never been harder in this age of media fragmentation and clutter. Yet, advertising remains the main crutch marketers use to promote their brands, notwithstanding evidence to suggest that it's becoming less and less effective, as Galloway noted. Marketing's job is to build brand equity, but that's not to be confused with brand image. Brand equity has to do with how important the brand is in the lives of people. As the legendary brand expert David Ocker once wrote, "The really strong brands have gone a step beyond achieving visibility and differentiation to develop deep relationships with a customer group. That is, the brand becomes a meaningful part of the customer's life." Brands that are on the periphery of people's lives, that are Me Too products, that lack a clear and distinctive identity, that are perceived to be substitutable, are doomed to compete forever on price. Whereas the most successful brands today offer a winning combination of product superiority and an enriching experience. The quality of that experience, the extent to which it becomes a shareable story, not just a credible one, is what earns a brand a loyal base of fans and keeps customers buying again and again. The challenge, of course, is gaining the confidence of customers that the brand deserves to be a part of their lives. To do so, marketers have to set their sights on changing those lives for the better, argues the noted brand consultant Alan Adamson, whose latest book, Seeing the How, chronicles how various innovative brands were able to do so. The trick, he says, is to deeply examine how people go about their day-to-day lives and the obstacles they face. He says the difference between products are so slight today that the only thing that can differentiate one from the other is the novelty and utility of that experience. Alan began his career at Ogilvy & Mather in 1979. I began by asking what enduring branding lessons he learned then that have stayed with him to this day.
The one lesson that I learned many things, when you first start in any job, your learning curve is pretty steep. So you tend to get a lot from your early experiences. But the one thing I got from Ogilvy that has helped me every day is learning how to write, to talk and recommend and communicate a strategy or an idea, something intangible. You know, when you learn to write in university, it's more of a narrative and it's engaging. But when you learn how to write for business, particularly the way it was done back in those days, you learned how to put a recommendation in an email, a letter. Here's what we recommend. Here's why. Here's what it gets you. You learned how to communicate in a business way. And Ogilvy was very disciplined, as you know, that part of their success was their ability to help their clients understand the recommendation and then put enough rationale in it that it was a smart business decision, not because it sounds like a fun idea, let's try something crazy. Right.
So there's always a logic, obviously, a brand strategy, really, behind the communications program.
Some thinking, you know, why? What's the idea? Bring it to life. But why you should do this? One, two, three, four, what are the implications? It just a different way to communicate. They you know, they're very diligent about how to write well. In fact, the former CEO way back when wrote a book called How to Write Well.
Well, David Ogilvy, really, the lessons he conveyed in those books are still true today. It's one of the great books in advertising that have been ever written. Well, let me just ask you this then. Your career spanned 4 decades now. You're one of the leading foremost experts in brand building in the world. What shifts have you seen? And I'm describing these as seismic shifts in brand strategy and thinking between those O&M days and now that you think have been impactful.
I think the biggest shift is that back in the good old days, when you solved a consumer problem and you invented something came to you from the lab or engineering and you had a product. I was lucky enough in my second chapter of my career to work at Unilever. And they had something called Dove soap, which was a better product. It was not just a soap. It was a detergent, which had better properties for your skin. And that advantage lasted them for 15, 20 years in the market, where all they had to say is Dove doesn't dry your skin like soap. And with that sort of differentiated product, that sustainable competitive advantage, then their task was to make sure to constantly keep that fresh and relevant and make that believable. The world we live in today is by the time someone hands you, I got this new great phone, and you say, let me just do an ad for it or some communications. What's the differentiation? There are going to be 5 things just like it. There are very few better mousetraps. And so from a communication point of view, if you have nothing different that matters, there's no unique selling proposition, it is much more difficult. I also spent a big chunk of my career working with P&G. Their success was often driven by a very old-fashioned idea, was a demo in the middle. They'd show, this plate is washed in Dawn, this plate is washed in something else. Look how much cleaner it is. This shirt's been washed and tied. And by showing the difference, people say, wow, that shirt is whiter. That shirt, those teeth are cleaner for Crest. I don't get cavities, 26% fewer. But those days are, gone. You try to define the difference between one laptop and another, one car and another. It's a nightmare, from the coffee cup holder to the, the phone interface. I rent a lot of cars when I travel. And when you're inside one of these, it's really hard to tell the difference between a Mercedes and a Hyundai.
So the shift that you're describing here is product parity has forced brands to move away from trumpeting functional value, is what you're suggesting.
Right. And they need to, it's no longer as easy as somebody in the lab coming to you and say, I have this new product that's going to cure headaches faster than anything else. There is, of course, still product differentiation happening, but as a percentage of what's in the market, you don't have to be a marketing expert to know when you go down the aisle at Target and try to buy almost any product, it's really hard to tell the difference in one shampoo and another. It's really, it's a sea of similarity. And I think sea of sameness, a better word. And in that world, the challenge of marketing is exponentially more difficult. That's one change. And of course, the other change is that, we've all been trained to tune out more and more, because there's so much media coming at us, it has exponentially increased. There are two things that have happened to the consumer. One, they've learned how to, put on the force field and they don't pay attention to anything anymore. But two, they've also learned to, multitask and not really, and their attention spans, the average consumer has a mild case of ADD. So if you can't, they're not going to listen to a long story as to why, you know, this car is better than that car. You know, they either get it fast or they internally change channels.
Right. There's an attention deficit challenge for the entire industry as the communications paradigm has changed rather dramatically. Are there, and again, I want to go back to your early training in P&G, and you're right, that was a training ground. Unilever was a training ground. O&M was a training ground. D&B was a training ground. Are there brand orthodoxies, myths that persist today that you'd like to see retired, that basically have passed their best buy date?
You know, I think a lot of the basics still apply. They're really hard to do. I'll tell you a story. You know, the need for focus and simplicity to break through. Because if you have a simple idea, which was my first book, Brand Simple, you can get more powerful creative. And if you get more powerful creative, you get noticed. You have a better story. And I was working at Ogilvy, and I was just out of business school, and I'm very excited. And I was on a coffee brand, and the creative director said, you know, we got a new campaign. Why don't you put together, you know, a memo, which is an email for your listeners. You know, what are the key points of this coffee, and what should we communicate in our new campaign? And I was, well, I got this, and I, you know, went back to my office and, you know, did the work, spoke to the client, and I, you know, put together a, you know, 2-page email, you know, where the beans were from and where I was roasted and the taste. And I was, you know, really excited. I brought it into her office and I said, Carol, here's the brief. And she looks at it and, oh, really? Now I know what you've been doing, Alan, for 2 weeks. This is really fabulous. You know, you've got incredible depth here. And then she takes a corner of the page and rips off the corner and shows me this little piece of, says, Alan, when you can put what you want to communicate about our coffee brand, your client's coffee, in this little scrap of paper, come back into my office again, but never come back in. You know, this is good for the Wikipedia entry, but if you want breakthrough creative, you better figure out the one thing we've got to communicate.
Well, I think that's always been a challenge for the industry, is really creating concise creative briefs that cut to the heart of why that brand should matter to people, right? It's always been.
And it's hard.
It is hard.
But what hasn't changed, I think, is I'm a big believer that we're all in a world of nonlinear problem solving. Conceptual problem. And so you just can't put all the facts on a piece of paper and add them up and divide by two and say, there's the answer. The catalyst for breaking through is somebody who is able to look at all those facts and come up with a completely fresh way to tell it that's relevant and different. Because in today's marketplace, there's so much noise that if you just say, I want to tell you about a coffee and here are 3 reasons to buy it, you don't even get to reason number one before somebody swipes across and you're gone.
Which is maybe the argument that brand may be even more important today than ever, frankly. I mean, in yesteryear, you know, 50s, 60s, 70s, when there were actually print publications, you had a little space and time to tell your story.
To tell your story, right. Now you have a TikTok second.
Yeah.
And yeah, that is a piece of that. You know, every year I watch the Super Bowl, like many, for the ads. And here's like, it's like the finals, and you've got 30 brands, each spending, you know, whatever number they want, every possible celebrity. And of those 30 brands or 35 brands, you know, you probably don't remember 15. You know, not that you're out, you know, getting a new a beer or something, but they just vaporize. You know, the remaining 15, you sort of, I remember a commercial for a car. I don't really remember what brand it is. It had a rabbit in the back, you know. And then for maybe 5, you say, I remember the car. It was a BMW, and they had this test track, but didn't convince me. And only like 3 or 4 get to the end goal. You break through. It tells you something about the product that you remember. And that's something they tell you just, you know, makes you want to go out and say, I'm going to buy a BMW. And so even in the World Series of advertising, where everyone is, you know, although their scale, you know, is a little different because there's so much pressure to say, hey, look at me. That, you know, if you just go with a great story and you don't have a breakthrough way to get it across, you still fail. But it just shows you how, even though there's there's been creativity in marketing and business for a long time. That remains difficult to do. And what's hardest to do about it, which you know and everyone else knows, is it's human nature is hard to buy great advertising because it's going to be different than everything you've seen in your rearview mirrors. So you're going to go and say, we should do this with this dancing duck. You know, it's going to sell a lot of health insurance because no one can pronounce Aflex. But, you know, it's never been done before. It seems silly. We can't really prove it. But we got to spend millions of dollars just to find out if it works or not. It's a really frightening thing.
Well, and you talk in the book about, I don't think you use the words divergent thinking, but I think you encourage companies to embrace diverse points of view to get to create a vision. We're going to come back to that theme because I think it was super important. But, you know, our careers started, and we're about the same vintage, I think, when ads were really the primary source of information for consumers. And today, of course, that's blown wide open. So the game has changed. And again, this is something you talk about in the book is the idea of rule breaking, and which you were just alluding to is think beyond the guardrails and figure out how to tell this either the story differently or create a different value proposition. Again, a key theme in the book, which we're going to come back to. But I want to pick up on something else we were talking about a short time ago, which is the idea of differentiation. So in the book, you make the point that points of differentiation alone are not enough to sustain a brand. And you also get a little bit to this idea of distinctiveness versus differentiation, which seems to be an ongoing debate. So what will sustain a brand if it's not being seen somehow as big or better or best than the competing alternatives?
You know, that ties to the first point we talked about, which is that even if you have something distinctive, the days till you have three other people that have the same thing are gone. You know, you're instantly going to get a better mousetrap. Ultimately, a brand needs to solve somebody's problem. You know, it has to, you know, at the highest level, the brand or the product or the service has to solve a problem. And you have to constantly be looking at that problem and say, am I solving it in the best way possible? You know, and in a way better than our competition. And often now that the difference is not so much the obvious one that your engineers develop. I mean, I hate to go back to the cell phones, but, you know, you try to differentiate between the 10 leading cell phones, smartphones, and it's pretty hard to do. They all have the same apps. They have the same camera. Yeah, maybe Google's phone takes better pictures, or, you know, Samsung's has a larger screen. But ultimately, they're all playing on that stage of telling you that this thing has features. But I would argue that the way Apple is staying ahead is, yes, they have to have as many features and toys and speeds and feeds as the other brands. But they're winning on customer service. You call up AppleCare, and especially for now that I'm an entrepreneur, and I'm having trouble with my Mac, and I can't get the PowerPoint open, and somebody will spend 20 minutes, 40 minutes, an hour with you. You don't have to line up at a Genius Bar. And that soft service to say, you know, I'm buying not only the technology, but I'm buying somebody there that is going to help me. In fact, when my daughter dropped her phone and her screen broke, you know, she's in school. They gave her a loaner for the week. So until they said, and so thinking through, you know, and that's all about the experience. And that's a whole much more difficult way to compete because crafting that experience. But that's what I mean when I say, you have to zoom out a bit and say, yes, if you have a better phone, you know, do tell that story and hope you have more than 60 days to enjoy your view from the top of the mountain until you find out there are five other people at the top of the mountain with you with a slightly better mousetrap.
Well, and just sticking with the concept of service being a differentiator, service to some extent has become table stakes too. And just knowing that customer satisfaction ratings haven't budged in 10 years would suggest that expectations keep rising. So you used to leapfrog in terms of product functionality. Today, you're trying to leapfrog in terms of service differentiation as well, aren't you?
And it's much harder to do. We can talk about that in terms of some of the findings from my latest book, because, you know, just having someone say, were you reasonably happy with, you know, the way we, you know, made your coffee today? They'll say, yeah. But, you know, does that mean I tell this story often. We were working for a pizza chain in the U.S., a big one. I won't name it. And they were saying, look, we've just done this research and, you know, 78% of our consumers like the taste of our pizza. They like the restaurant. They like the, you know, but our sales are down. So the advertising can't be right or something has to change. And then a smart moderator from the research firm said, well, let's ask another question. Let's ask, you know, if this company went out of business, what would you do? And instantly, oh, I go to Papa John's. So there was, you know, so even though they said it was good, it was not good enough to, you know, to spend 10 cents more on a slice than across the street. So you have to be careful when you say, you know, how am I doing? Because consumers want to give you the answer, oh, Stephen, you're doing great. Okay, no one wants to give bad news. But really to find out what it takes to get you to go, wow, that's a different challenge.
It was a great anecdote in the book. I remember reading that because it harkens back to a client I've worked with where, you know, they were quite happy with their CustSat ratings because most people said, yeah, we're happy with the experience. But then you ask them the question of do you prefer us over the competition? And half the people said, well, you're about the same. And that's death to a brand to be considered about the same, right, I would
exactly.
say.
Exactly. If you can't see the difference, why pay the difference?
Exactly. And so, yeah, it's a key thing. So we're going to come back to some of these points a little later. But another debate, if I can put it that way, going on in the industry today is the idea of brand building versus performance marketing. I'm sure you saw the article recently in Harvard Business Review on this exact topic. There's factions that have been created within companies, us against them on this topic. How can marketers achieve some sort of equilibrium between the two, between traditional brand building, which builds the brand for the long term, and this idea of performance marketing, which is really short-term demand generation? How do they get there? It's a difficult topic for a lot of companies.
Well, you know, it's easy if you have a better mousetrap, then to some extent, if you want this performance and just telling that story through demand gen works. But in most cases, it's not one or the other, it's both. And it's if you don't have the brand solved, you're going to spend a lot more money on demand gen that's going to be a lot less ineffective. So it's finding that yin-yang. And it's hard, you know, it remains hard because demand gen can be, you know, much more digitally accurately delivered. Getting a brand messages all the way down to that granularity of every eyeball is a little more difficult. And a lot of brands don't have a clear story anyway. So, you know, people spend money on brand and they're out there saying, you know, we're quality, we care about our customers. And the message, you know, for a brand to be successful, it has to have a great strategy. And lots of marketers, as you know, get instantly enamored with the bells and whistles and the activation, and don't focus on do they have the right story.
Well, it's part of, I think, generally, the challenge that marketers have today is they've been expelled, if you will, from the strategy discussions because they are doing exactly what you're talking about. They're talking about activation as opposed to creating new value for customers. I want to delve into that a little bit more because it does relate to brand. And again, it's something you touch on in the book is the idea of brand versus branding. They're not the same, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a simple nuance, but if you stop and think, I like to tease them apart. A brand is your story. When someone hears your product or company name, when I hear, you know, Delta Airlines, you know, what story pops into my head? You know, branding is how you get that story. Delta is always raising expectations or whatever the brand promise is. I think it's close to raising expectations. Once you get that story right, then branding is how you get it from the PowerPoint into somebody's head. And it could be advertising. It could be owned media. It could be a customer experience. It could be somebody at the airport. You know, there are influencers. You know, there are 50 ways to get a brand story or strategy into someone's head. But marketers tend to always look at the shiny objects and get really focused on, you know, are we going to do influencer? Or what's our social strategy? You know, we have enough, you know, direct to consumer work here going on. And, you know, that's important, but there's usually not enough pressure testing and saying, well, even if I get this story into Steven's head, you know, is it going to work? Is it the right story? Is it clear? Is he going to care? So, you know, but because it's so much more interesting on the branding side, you get people say, oh, you know, our sales are down. We must need a new ad, or we must need a new identity, or we must need a new influencer. Because in instance, if things aren't working, people jump to, it must be one of the little levers on the dashboard.
Or they're or making the case for likes and followers. You know, it's,
yeah, exactly. Yeah, lots of likes. It's got to work. And so it's really, as you know, and it's you can have a great brand story and also fail because you have bad execution. You have bad you have bad social media. You have bad and so you can fail on both sides of that equation. But if you don't think about them separately and together, if you just think about one and not the other. Yeah, I talk to my students often at in class when I do some lecturing. You know, if you go into the gap, what is a gap? What's gap's problem? Is it a brand or a branding problem? And students will say, well, their advertising is boring, and the stores are, you know, generic, or you know, the jeans are not that nice. And those are a product. Those are all branding things. And my answer is, I don't know. I haven't worked with the Gap. But I would argue that if you go in and talk to 10 Gap employees, you just go into the floor of a Gap store and say, can you give me something typically Gap to wear? They have no clue what typical Gap is. And so, yes, their advertising is probably is not great, and their store design and their help. So they have lots of other issues on the branding side. But if the core is like, if no one on the floor can tell you, you know, Steven, this sweater is really Gap. Let me tell you why it has that Gap edge, whatever it is. But and that's hard to do in fashion. But if you don't start to make that story, if it's just come to the Gap because we've got lots of stuff on the floor or online and we're a decent price, not a good story.
Well, and if you go back to that HBR article, Jim Stengel co-authored it. They try to make the point that tying the concept of brand equity to the measures that matter, the CFO and the CEO is really key, because otherwise no one really understands what brand even is for the most part, right?
Too many people think it's awareness or, you know, likes, as opposed to this, you know, is it a driver of business value? Can we charge more for our product? Because people think, you know, if I buy this toy, it's better than that toy, or this service is better than that service.
There's also an ongoing debate beyond brand building versus performance marketing around brand purpose. And it was the hottest topic of day for a while. But there's a lot of contentious debate around that as well. In your view, how important, and this goes back, I think, to the question of brand strategy, how important is purpose to building strong brands?
I think it can be important. But my take is it's really hard to do and has to extend well beyond, you know, what the marketing department does. Because to truly deliver a purpose, it needs to be a commitment of the entire company. It takes a long time. You know, if I think of the cases where purpose is paid off, you know, Patagonia, you know, everything the company did was tied to sustainability from how they compensated their employees to fly to, you know, carbon. It was a long journey. And so but most often today marketers say, we have this purpose, you know, and they do an ad campaign. And one, it's hard to believe. And two, you know, they're not convincing people that they really stand for something. So while everyone gets excited about it, because it's above the product level, but I think for every 10 purpose brands, you know, only, you know, two are successful, because it's hard to execute.
But go back to a core theme in your book, which is to be successful today, a brand has to, I think I'm using your words, be entrenched in people's lives. Is it the idea of brand purpose to say we are there to improve those lives. And if the two can be done in conjunction, that is, a delivering value that does truly improve people's lives. And that's, in fact, what I stand for as a business. Isn't that the ideal state here?
Sometimes it's too high level. If you know, in other words, an old principle is to be successful in brand, you have to focus. If your promise is too broad, it's too general. So if you just make people's lives better and you're a candy company, you're really tough to do. I think it needs to be a promise that's at that level, but something that you can own a little bit and believe. So I hate to go back to Unilever product, but I do think Dove's Real Beauty has been a good example of a purpose and end benefit above the, when I was a Dove, about soft skin, that, and they've done a pretty good job of staying with it and bringing it to life. And it's relevant for, they're in skincare and beauty and, but for every Dove, there are five other brands that have said something either too big or they haven't been able to pay it off, even if it's small.
Right. And it only really works if it truly is a North Star for an organization with all stakeholders, not just consumers, right?
Right, because it can't be, because otherwise, if it's just a marketing department, it's a communications, it's a spin thing. And the one thing about consumers is they've had a better nose for BS, and they're just more skeptical than ever. So if you tell them that your machine bolt company is here to make the, we have bolts that it's going to make the world a better place. Click.
Right. I think the other adjunct conversation here is that it's also about values, right? So I think people today want to obviously do business with companies that have good values. And I don't know that you can have good values without being clear about, what value you're bringing to the world, but I want to reference one of your colleagues at NYU Stern School of Business, Scott Galloway. He was at Cannes recently, and he, as his usual provocative self, declared, and I'm sure you read this, the era of the brand is over, he said. And one of his proof points was that even some of the most trusted brands in the world, and he referenced Apple as well, are in fact cutting back on ads. What's your perspective on that, on his point of view that the era of the brand is over?
Well, I didn't hear his talk, although I like listening to one of his seven podcasts that he does.
I don't know if he has time to do that.
I have trouble with the linkage of Apple's brands to how much Apple spends on advertising. I think part of what makes the Apple brand successful is probably least connected to advertising, and probably more tied up to the in-store experience, the customer service, the product design, the fact that the core, getting back to my story where the creative director, rips off the corner of the page. If, when I think about Apple, I think about, its core thing on that little scrap of paper that somebody handed to the creative directors, if you have to read the instructions, it's too complicated. And, if you remember technology from 10 or 20 years ago, and you bought anything from anything electronic, even a clock radio, if people remember what that was, the instruction book looked like you were going to launch a nuclear missile, and it was written and translated Chinese and so, there was nothing intuitive about technology, and no one wants to be seen, as inept. And so I think, yes, I think brands are different. And I think, Scott, the reason he was able to go to Cannes and be on his yacht is because he started a pretty big brand firm called Prophet.
Yeah, he did. It was a great brand. Yeah, and did very well by it. That's for sure. And Scott Galloway, I might add, has a great brand.
Yeah. He's done polishing that pretty well.
Yeah.
But not a lot of advertising, but, he's probably got a clear brand strategy as to what the right amount of edge, the right amount of, surprise and a little bit abrasive, and something saying and picking things that are completely contrarian. So he knows his GPS is already even though he says brands are dead, his GPS is helping him build a personal brand that's better than most.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I did think that was ironic when he said that. I thought, well, Scott, if you didn't have a brand, you wouldn't be the guy you are today. So let's move on to your book, because the book's great. And I particularly like how you interleave your personal stories with concrete examples of companies. And there's really no discussion of advertising the book at all. This is really about, in my mind anyway, value proposition. But let me just see if I can summarize the gist of the book and just get you to comment on whether I've got this right or not. But it seems that the gist is that you're saying that companies got to, well, this is the title of your book, but that companies need to be asking how, not what. It's the most important thing a brand can do today to be successful. That brands can lead us to experience the world differently. Have I got that right?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, tying off the ramble we had earlier in the conversation where, you know, people, two things are going on. One, people, there's not that much real meaningful product difference. So if you're only out there saying buy this brand because it tastes 12% better than some other brand, tough haul. And, you know, the one media channel I haven't talked about that much is that the elephant in the room today is a word of mouth and word of eye. Online are powerful. They've always been powerful, but now so very powerful. But no one gets up and says, you know, I had breakfast. No one gets on social media and says, I had some cereal this morning and it was okay. Oh, and you know, it tasted pretty crunchy and you know, it didn't upset my stomach. You know, so no one, they don't share good performance and they don't share ordinary things. They're only going to share that if you opened a box of cereal and a mouse came out, you know, that will do well on social media. Or if it was such a phenomenal that you could run the marathon afterwards, you had so much energy. So in that world, you have to look at how your brand, service, product, whatever offer, is going to fit into someone's life and how you can make it, ironically, going back to what you said with purpose, make their lives better in a way that goes a little beyond just it cleans teeth 12% better than the other toothpaste.
Well, I particularly liked your comment that average is over. Average doesn't win you many sales anymore. And to your point, people talk about their great experiences, the things that they particularly remember, and the bad ones. But is the objective here to create memorable experiences? Is that the starting point here? If you're thinking about, go back to the point about differentiation, how can I create a memorable?
Well, the objective is, in my generation, when you started marketing, you started with in P&G days, there was a box of detergent on the conference room table. When I was at Kraft, there was a box of cereal on the table. You know. So where we always began was when the product appeared, the car drove onto the showroom floor. And my thought is that, yes, if you have a better car and, you know, and it's unique, that's a good place to start. But if you're like most cars or most products, there's not a lot there anyway. Zoom out and think of how is this product going to fit into someone's life and what do we need to do around it to make that overall experience from purchase to use to reuse to repair to convenience better. And some of it could be as easy as taking out some friction so it's easier. But a lot of that friction is already out. But for most categories, you know, it's not too hard to get anything anymore. You don't have to line up, you know. But, you know, part of it is remembering that a product slash brand has to either give a benefit and make it really easy and fun to use or different to use, make it shareable, do something that surprises people, or solve a problem in a slightly different way.
Well, and I want to jump on that because many of the examples in the book and all of them are examples of successful companies that have thought in a divergent way about the category. So they've actually rethought the category. How they got to that epiphany is often through personal experience, it would seem. But that seemed to me the starting point, not how can we do this big, better, or best, but it's how can we do this differently in a way that will fit in better with people's lives.
Yeah, Exactly. And, you know, I don't think it used to be you needed a big offer to do this. But, you know, lots of the technology to do better brands is right in front of us. You know, I don't think I made the book, but I took my car a couple of years ago, a year and a half ago, to get, when you buy a car, sometimes they throw in the first service at the dealership. So I took it to the dealership. And, you know, the usual experience, having owned many cars, you know, it's always a challenging experience when you do car repair, at least in the U.S. You know, they come out and say, Alan, you know, we've looked under the hood, we put the car up, and your blank, blank, blank is not connected to the XYZ. And, you know, unfortunately, that's a really expensive part. It's going to be, $600. And you go, I guess I need it, you know, and you hopefully trust the person. And so my car went into the dealer, and all of a sudden I get a text saying, you know, open it up, and it's a video. And it says, hi, I'm at the dealership, and we're under your car now. Here's a little video, and I want to show you your brake pads. You know, you see this shiny thing? That means they've already worn through. Now, I don't think we need to replace that right now, but I want to show you that when you come in next, we're really close. But this gasket here, and all of a sudden you're doing like a video. And so for years, I've had the same experience, no matter if I went to an expensive dealer or Billy Joe's little garage down the street. It was the same, trust me, this is what I found, unless it's a tire and you see it's blown out. But all of a sudden, the simple piece of, you know, not quite an iPhone, but giving, letting them take a smartphone and make that, it's changed. I think it will change how you get car service. If you, no matter what the issue is, you want to show me, take me under the hood and show me that belt that's broken before you tell me I needed one and you have to trust me.
Yeah, no, it's a great example of really zoning in on an issue that bothers people and then coming up with what clearly was a very ingenious solution.
But it's not, again, yeah, but it's looking at the consumer and saying, well, and there's no one saying, if you went to someone and said, how can I make your car service experience better, going to a consumer, they go, well, charge less or make it faster or, you know, give me better coffee while I wait. They wouldn't say, you know, why don't you take your iPhone and make a little movie of what's wrong underneath? So you can't ask the consumer for that, because they'll just say, well, like every other car place, you're fine. You know, yes, I think your coffee's a little bitter.
I want to come back to that, because it's really key to success here, and that's clear in your book. I do want to come back to this idea of entrenching the brand in people's lives, because that's a pretty high bar. Most brands, I would argue, live on the periphery of people's lives. They're not core to their lives. So the word entrenched would suggest that they're central to those lives. Does that brand have to become indispensable, you know, something they can't live without? Or can it live on the periphery and still be entrenched in people's lives? Explain the demarcation there for me.
You know, it's because there are different ways to get entrenched. You could get entrenched because you have a product and something else on, like, the market, and so you're used to playing with this tennis racket, and you've always won your games with this. And so even though you can't define what tennis racket, you know, why your Prince is better than, you know, you're entrenched. But, you know, often today, entrenched means they've done something. Usually it's to make it better for you and you feeling special or customized, that this is my brand. And customization's been around for a long time. But, you know, I do think, you know, it is still important, particularly in categories where there's, you know, you look at hotels. It's hard when you're in a hotel. It's you know, traveling on business, you wake up. You don't know what city you're in. The room has the same flat screen TV, the same, you know, maybe this one has a fluffier pillow. But so, you know, creating some differentiation there is going to be tied to whether it's a loyalty program or them really knowing you much, much better. And when you travel these days, all of a sudden, every airline, every car is getting better and better at that customization thing. I recently read, I'm a fan of Delta, having worked with them for a couple years back in my career. But, you know, they just added something to their, here's another example. They added something to their app, which says, when you get off the curb at most airports. It will now tell you not only that you're at gate 42 and your flight's at 10:05, which is nice to know, important to know. It's always, you can always look on a screen too, but it will also tell you how long it's going to take you to get through security, how long that gate is a 15-minute walk. You know, the line at the Starbucks there is also 10. In other words, it's a way. So all of a sudden, you know, providing you with, and once they get you hooked on, you know, when you fly Delta, that if you're at this airport, you're not going to, you know, the TSA's line's too long, you know, you can't stop and talk to somebody. You know, so again, it's like if you ask somebody, how can I make this flight better? You know, they wouldn't get to, you know, in a crowded airport with people coming both ways, how long is it going to take me to get to 42B?
And this is where I think marketing empathy comes into play. And again, we're gonna come swing back to that shortly. I do want to pick up on one other comment you make in the book, which is customer centricity is a concept most marketers don't fully understand. I couldn't agree more with that statement. My question to you is, why do you think that is? Why do you think it's such a challenge?
It's. I think, yeah. One, as you said, it's a cliche. If you ask any company, say, what do you do right? Oh, we really know our customers. You know, we're customer centric. It's probably one of the most overused words in business. But I think there are many reasons. But one of the reasons is that I experienced it when I was in marketing. Is you're so busy in meetings, reading emails, you know. Going from that, you lose your observational skills. You lose seeing things firsthand. And most executives read a top line customer satisfaction. Look at a dashboard. You know, net promoter score up 6%. This and that can tell you how you're doing on the macro scale. But you know, by the time lots of those indicators move, it's usually game over and it's hard to catch up. And so part of it, I think, is the need for marketers to realize, and this is another premise of my book, that in theory, marketers should be the ones closest inside the company, whether it's a dry cleaning shop or a big company, closest to the customer. And if they think their job is more than just selling the product, but to really know Steven and watch him and scratch their head and do a little Jerry Seinfeld, you ever wonder why? They should come back with that, not so much, so here's how you sell Steven a new pair of glasses, but they should say, you know, I think we could solve Steven's problems better if we did, you know, they need to take a bigger role in innovation and changing the offer and being the one to suggest to their car service friends, you know, in the service department that why don't we show little videos? And I think that's the, so customer centricity means that they have some macro sense that their customers, as we went back to the earlier comment, are happy. But that's, you know, everyone knows you're happy until somebody gives you a better offer. you know, people are probably happy with the Edsel until, you know, not the Edsel, with the Model T until the next model came out. So, you know, it's hard to do because it's constantly changing. And it does require getting out from inside your bubble.
It's a transformation in mindset from product centricity to customer centricity because all of the reasons we described earlier and the challenges that organizations have in embracing it culturally and organizationally and how they're organized, which is I'm approaching that topic here because one of the things you emphasize and it's so true is that as the opportunities are incredibly hard to see. They do require, I think you use the word seeing things other people don't see. Is this an argument for systematized first principles thinking, for divergent thinking, like as a sort of a standard process within an organization? Like, how do we get there? You can't hire clairvoyance.
No, I think part of it is going back to something we touched on earlier is keeping fresh eyes. So, you know, you go to a company, I'll pick a beer company, and you talk to them about marketing the beer. I've been in the beer business 15 years. This is how we do it. You know, they learn what is, and then they feel comfortable in that world until what is doesn't work anymore. And I remember a conversation I had with HBO about 8 years ago. And they were doing something really interesting. I didn't put this in a book here, but it was in my
previous book, one of my previous books, they would hire interns from universities. And the typical thing for interns used to be, or is, you know, go in this cubicle and here's a pile of numbers and, you know, do something. But they forced their C-suite to get the interns, to have these 20-something kids who, when they, you know, as a way to keep their executive levels understanding what's going on with 21-year-olds and Gen Z and Gen X, because they realized that the higher up in the company you went, the more inside the bubble you became. And, you know, it's important. Yeah, and a 21-year-old will be still ever say, gee, you know, that's, why don't you do this? And at a certain point, people don't ask, why don't you do this anymore? They lose that, you know, everything looks sort of normal. I mean, you look at what the pandemic did. And if I had said to my team, you know, we're going to pitch a client in Dallas, but, you know, we'll try something different. We're not going to fly down to Dallas and go into the conference room. We're going to suggest that they get on FaceTime, and we're going to do it virtually. And we're going to tell them we work smarter. But culture, it was not, you know, it was, you know, you took a, you know, to change people's, you know, and all of a sudden, if you tell somebody, I want to fly out and talk to you for 30 minutes, the client will say, yeah, that's great. Thank you very much, Alan. But first of all, I only have 20 minutes and I'm not paying your, you know, bus fare here. So let's do it on Microsoft Teams.
Well, it's. I think that resistant mindset is the reason why a lot of digital transformations, business transformations, in fact, fail. It's such hard work, it takes such fortitude and perseverance. And you know, as I said earlier, this podcast is all about marketing transformation, and it's extremely difficult for marketers today, I think, to embrace some of the changes that you're recommending here. So let me ask you this then: if it does require this divergent thinking, how do you organize around that? Now, let's go back to the challenge here. So you have the traditional product management in place. You have marketers whose job it is to take what the guys in product management come up with and make and sell it, which is largely they've been confined to that role. They aren't the voice of the customer. They should be. I agree completely with that. How do you reorganize to facilitate, systematize, sort of the shift in thinking that's required and the development of value propositions ultimately that would enable companies to replicate what a lot of the case studies in your book have succeeded in doing?
You know, if it was one simple thing, like, you know, take two aspirins and call me in the morning, everyone would do it. The, you know, the problem is it's multidimensional. But, you know, one of the things, the easy one, is that We tend to, in business, hire people that are just like us most of the time. Oh, you went to the school, you were in my fraternity, you're in. And, you know, all of a sudden you got 10 people, all who had the same experience, all looking at the world through this tunnel. And so part of success is, you know, you need to hire somebody from the left and right, not better school, different school, but with a different background, a different part of the country, different experience. So there's that need to zoom out and get people on your team that just have different skills. Otherwise, you know, you'll think you're great, but you'll be, and I see it a lot in professional service firms when the consulting firm is pitching us in a big company. You know, everyone has a black and white picture. They all look the same. You know, they'll have the bio. Yeah, it's there's a, you know, again, a sea of similarity, but they can help you be more aware of that. The other thing that we do internally that's bad in companies, and the bigger the company, the worse it is, and you see it all the time when they're on the Wall Street Journal about to go out of business, is there's a culture of Stephen saying, you know, I think this is the case, Alan. I think we should. Oh, right, Steve. There is such a pressure to not disagree with the boss. In fact, before the boss's meeting, you know, everyone says, well, here's what we're going to say. Now, if the boss says he doesn't like it, you know, no one argue with, you know, and there is this ability to, you know, to be different is hard inside a company, to be, you know, to have a contrarian point of view. And there was a great movie with Robin Williams where he plays Dead Poets Society. And early on, he's a crazy poet at this prep school in New England. But he talks to the kids about how important it is to make sure they get comfortable with their difference. Everyone has a difference. And I think in companies, step one is
you zoom out hiring, be more, if there's not a good debate, if everyone says, great idea, I'd say, you know, danger. sometimes it could be. And then there is the, a colleague of mine who's a CMO of Accenture said this, fail quickly and often. In other words, rather than package it and let's do the pre-meeting before the fall thing, you know, just get it out there, put it out there and do it quickly. Don't spend a year polishing things and then fail. It's better to put it out there, try it, iterate. And I think we're in that world that where execution matters. Lots of companies fail not because they have the wrong idea, because they only executed it 80%. I like the Calendly story from the book because, you know, Google had calendars, Apple had calendars, and everyone was doing the same game until somebody in sales said, you know, what's the problem with the calendar is not inputting that I'm having a call with Stephen at 2 o'clock. The challenge is finding, you know, when is Stephen free? It's 14 calls and I have two assistants doing it as opposed to, so in other words, it just took somebody who was out of the category. And they had all these big tech companies who all had the technology to make a better calendar system, but it was created by an entrepreneur because, you know, they're not seeing the real problem.
Right.
Because if you have somebody.
It's a great example. It's in your drill down lens chapter in the book. And it is a fabulous example of focusing in on a specific pain point, if you will, and figuring out a way to solve it. I have a couple more questions just in the remaining time here. And I want to go back to this issue of marketing myopia. And I don't know if you've seen the movie BlackBerry, but it's got to be the classic business case for a company that rose to fame and fortune very quickly, finding a problem in the market and solving it creatively, and then turning its back on creativity by sticking with what they knew to work. And it was back to back. Like, one moment they'd come up with an idea that basically created a category, and the next moment they're being destroyed by a company that's reimagined the category, which is, of course, what Apple did. So marketing myopia, Theodore Levitt wrote about this issue, many years ago. What will it take for organizations to, and we were talking a little earlier about change management, does this require the ability to have basically people who are creative thinkers who think outside the box as a group of provocateurs in a company looking forward instead of backwards and bringing and with research, these ideas to management to say, look out, here's what's around the corner for you. Is there a requirement here for organizations to arm themselves with this type of cadre group that, would rattle the chains if they had to?
Yeah, I looked a lot at this topic, having worked on BlackBerry just as it was crashing, and other big brands at that point. Yeah, myopia was one of them. Kodak thought they were in the film business and didn't realize that was going away. At BlackBerry, had a BlackBerry. But like everything, there's usually more than one factor. BlackBerry had a lot of arrogance. They said, no, this is, they didn't want to believe, what they saw. And another big one is that, if a product's making some, no one really gets serious about changing anything until the sky starts falling. So if sales are up and you're making money, we're not going to take $10 away from Steven, who's selling a lot of BlackBerries, and have it, invest in something new because we're making great margin here, no margin there. So, and by the time sales start to fall, you're usually too late. So that's why the more successful the company is, the more vulnerable it is to being incredibly disrupted because they then move to the optimization of the current game. And anything else they do besides make little boxes with keyboards is going to be less profitable. Again, it's really hard to, but those are the times and you either, and the team that ultimately gets to be the captain of the ship in those very successful companies tends to be far more operational. They tend to be better at optimizing and taking cost out and winning the hand they've been played. They tend not to be great at saying, well, give me 4 new cards and let me think what I can do with them.
Exactly. Yeah, that's exactly right. Well, that's a great way to end this interview, Alan. I think that's a terrific. The book again is a terrific, easy read too. It's very accessible. You're a great writer, so quite enjoyed the book, and you have some important lessons I think to convey here to folks who are looking at how to differentiate themselves in the marketplace. So thank you for this.
Thanks for inviting me. It was a great conversation. I enjoyed chatting with you.
That concludes my interview with Alan Adamson. As we learn, the old school approach to brand building through advertising is no longer effective in a world where achieving a sustainable advantage on product superiority alone is no longer doable. It's only a matter of time before a competitive product comes along making the same claims. For any brand today, the starting point should be thinking about how to make people's lives better, not how to get them to buy. If that experience is novel, if it solves a vexing problem for a customer in a way no one has ever thought of or even realized was a problem, it can fuel brand growth in a way that no amount of advertising can ever hope to do. But that requires marketers to be able to see past their assumptions and biases, to look at the world differently. And that can be tough when in many businesses, conformity is more valued than imagination. You can find past episodes of this podcast on customerfirstthinking.ca, where you'll also find articles, strategic frameworks, video, and more on the transformation of marketing. In closing, a big shout out to my friend and colleague, Justin Eacock, for his contribution to making this podcast happen. Until next time, thanks for listening.